Oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session. Pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Judge Hightower will be along. Several of us were at a meeting, and he was seated next to the governor, and the rest of us weren't. So he will participate in the deliberation. We have 10 policies this morning on our oral submission docket. In the order in which they are presented, they are as follows. Ford Motor Company versus the Honorable Bonnie Leggett, judge and original mandamus proceeding. And Union Pump Company versus Sue Albritton from Jefferson County. In each of these causes, we have allotted 20 minutes for oral argument. The relator or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal. The arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience, and if you desire to listen to a tape, you may make application with our clerk. Court is ready to hear argument for Malaycar and Ford Motor Company versus Leggett.
May it please the court, Mr. Craig A. Morgan will present argument for Malaycar. The relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I am Craig Morgan with Brown McCarroll and Oaks Heartline representing relator Ford Motor Company. This mandamus action concerns an order compelling discovery by which the trial court directed Ford to answer three interrogatories concerning its settlements with other claimants and provide a number of documents which Ford claims privilege and fell within the scope of several of the plaintiff's requests for production. With respect to all these interrogatories and all these documents, Ford contends the trial court abused its discretion. But to turn first to the interrogatories, this order directs Ford to tell these plaintiffs the dollar amount that Ford has paid other plaintiffs in other lawsuits to settle claims for personal injuries allegedly caused by accidents involving the Ford Bronco II. This is a transparent effort to obtain, through the use of discovery, information which will neither be admissible in itself nor could lead to the discovery of admissible evidence, but instead would be used by the plaintiffs to calculate their own settlement strategies and perhaps for purposes of public dissemination, neither of which is an appropriate use of the discovery process, and Ford contends the trial court abused its discretion by endorsing it. The plaintiffs, quite simply, have no authority to support the use of the discovery mechanism to obtain this information.
Are these subject to confidentiality, all of them subject to confidentiality agreements? You suggest that some of them may be, but are all of them, or does it make any difference to your argument?
No, it does not make any difference as far as Ford is concerned. The review that we've conducted, which I confess is not in the record, indicates that some of them are subject to confidentiality agreements, others are not. It's kind of difficult to gather all of them given the broad scope of their request, but that's not the point. The point is that this information is conceivably used only to manipulate the plaintiff's own settlement demand. We are talking about the dollar amount paid here. We're not talking about the existence of the other claims or the facts involving the other accidents or the existence of other accidents. Ford has agreed to provide all that information to the plaintiffs. It does not want to tell them the dollar amount paid to settle the claims.
Mr. Morgan, it seems to me that whenever somebody's arguing that they shouldn't produce information, I mean, relevance is sort of the threshold, and, you know, leading to discoverable information is sort of a threshold, but it almost invariably comes down to it may be relevant or it may lead to admissible, but there's some reason, I don't know, trade secret or business practice or some concern to the party that they don't want to release this information because if that information gets released, it's hurtful to that party. Knowing who they settled with, knowing the claim that was settled, and knowing the parties to the settlement, but we just want to be able to block out this little number here. I mean, how does that rise to some sort of significance that, boy, the trial court allows them to learn what the amount in this settlement agreement, even though they can know everything else about it, this is a clear abuse of trial court discretion. I mean, how does that kind of rise to sort of a saying, trial court, you shouldn't have done this?
Your Honor, for the same reason that the information will not be admissible at the trial, and that is that, and reflected by the decisions of every recorded court of appeals opinion on this point, and that is to allow plaintiffs to find out how much the defendant paid other similarly situated claimants would promptly undermine the motivation of defendants to settle at all. And the information is not admissible. It's not reasonably calculated, conceivably calculated to anything that would be admissible. The dollar amount we're talking about here.
Yeah, but I mean, I could just get the settlement agreement, find out who you settled with, and call them on the phone and say how much you settled for. I mean, that information is known by the party that got it.
And if they go through that process and there's not a confidentiality agreement and they contact all those people and they're willing to tell them that information, then we don't have a complaint. But what's at issue here is a court's order directing us to provide that information pursuant to a request that uses the rules of discovery to force us to provide that information. That's the problem. There are confidentiality agreements with respect to a number of these settlements. The plaintiffs in those cases will probably honor and will not tell them.
But your objection is not pertaining to those for which there's an agreement among the parties not to disclose it. You go to just, we don't want to tell them.
That's right, Your Honor. We do not believe it's an appropriate use of discovery for a plaintiff in a civil lawsuit to require the defendant to tell the plaintiff the dollar amount that defendant has paid other similarly situated claimants, because there's no legitimate purpose for that. The only transparently obvious objective of that request is so the plaintiffs can calculate their own settlement demand and perhaps for public dissemination, neither of which is proper, and there's just no way that's going to lead to admissible evidence at trial. And that's the point. All discovery requests have to fall within the scope of something that's relevant or reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence, and this is not. This would be the first reported decision in Texas to allow this discovery. It would be the first reported decision in Texas to allow either the discovery of settlement amounts paid in other lawsuits or the admission of that evidence at trial. This is utterly unprecedented in this state.
We've had opportunities to write on this issue. I think at least two cases from Travis County has come up to our court on mandamus, and the court refused to deal with it. Are you familiar with those cases?
No, I'm not. Is this concern admissibility or discoverability?
Discovery.
I'm not familiar with either of those cases. The existing law on this point should be respected, and that is that in order to recognize the repeatedly emphasized public policy of this state to encourage settlements, defendants should not be required to tell plaintiffs how much they paid other plaintiffs to settle similar claims. Now, turning to the documents, there are two sets of documents. The documents at issue here fall within two general groups. In the interest of time, I'll focus on one. But there is an overarching problem with all of these documents in both groups, and that is simply this: as a threshold dispositive point, Ford, on three occasions reflected in the record, tendered all of these documents to the trial court for in-camera inspection. The trial court declined to inspect any of them, but instead ordered all of them produced over Ford's objection that they are privileged. That in itself was an abuse of discretion.
Ms. Morgan, let me ask you on that one. Did you represent to the trial court that the law governing the attorney-client privileges protecting some of these documents in Texas was similar to that in Michigan?
Yes, and that was erroneous.
Okay, so you're before us saying that what you provided to the trial court was wrong.
On the representation, the law is the same. The representation on what Michigan law is was correct. That brief erroneously overlooked the National Tank decision concerning the control group test in Texas. But with respect to the Michigan law...
Was that called the trial court's attention before this action was brought to us?
The National Tank decision?
No, oh. Did you call the trial court's attention that you were mistaken in telling her that Michigan law was the same as Texas law?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I'm sure the plaintiff's pointing that out. But the point on Michigan law is correct. And that brings me to the to the next point. The law in Texas, at any rate, is that the trial court abuses its discretion if it does not review documents tendered for in-camera inspection when it is a claim of privilege before ordering all those documents produced. And here the trial court did that. And for that reason alone, the trial court committed reversible error.
There's a factual dispute between the parties. I believe the real parties in interest take the position that you haven't established that the judge didn't conduct an in-camera inspection. You said the documents were tendered, but I think they take the position that there's no proof that the judge didn't look at them and that they were tendered to her to review. What's your position?
Your Honor, a close reading of the record demonstrates that argument's unsupportable. The documents were offered to the court on three separate occasions. The court did not take physical possession of those documents before issuing its order directing the documents to be produced. There's simply no way the court could have reviewed the documents prior to ordering their production. These documents, the first group of documents on which I'd like to focus, consist of approximately 30 pages containing a memorandum from the Vice President and General Counsel of Ford Motor Company to a committee of directors and senior officers of that company containing the attorney's advice and the minutes from a subsequent meeting of that committee at which that advice was discussed. That communication and those documents fall squarely within any reasonable scope, any reasonable interpretation of an attorney-client privilege attached to a corporate client. But furthermore, this was a communication between an attorney in Michigan and the directors and officers of a corporation with its principal place of business in Michigan at a meeting in Michigan at the Michigan headquarters of that corporation 10 years before the accident issue in this case happened. The privileges that attach to that communication are governed by Michigan law. Is Michigan has the most significant relationship to that communication and to the privileges that attach to it. It is the location where the communication occurred, and it is the state that is most central to that attorney-client relationship. And under the restatement that this court has announced an intent to follow in conflicts matters, Michigan has the most significant relationship, and it is Michigan law that governs the scope of that privilege. And under Michigan law, our briefs were correct. Michigan does not follow the control group test. Michigan applies the federal practice, follows the Upjohn decision, and does not limit the attorney-client privilege for communications with a corporate client to communications with those only within its control group. The central focus of the plaintiff's argument in the trial court and its argument throughout this appeal has been on the control group test under Texas law, and that's not applicable to a communication that occurred a decade ago in Michigan between a Michigan attorney and a Michigan client. Any contrary rule would create instant chaos. If the confidentiality of communications between Michigan attorneys and Michigan clients in Michigan is to be determined subsequently, 10 years later, by the law of the state 1,000 miles away, then parties to that communication at the time have no reasonable basis on which to determine whether that conversation is going to be confidential. Furthermore, they have absolutely no idea what state they should look to find out. Furthermore, and most disturbing, Michigan no longer has any control over its public policy concerning the confidentiality of communications between Michigan attorneys and Michigan clients in Michigan, and the same would be true for Texas. This state would no longer have control over the confidentiality of communications between Texas lawyers and Texas clients in Texas if the scope of that privilege is to be determined later by the law of some other state anywhere in the country a decade later in a lawsuit that has jurisdiction over one of those parties. That is not the law and cannot be the law.
Let me ask you a question. Does Ford Motor Company build any cars in Texas?
I'm not sure. I believe they might.
I know Chevrolet has a plant up in Arlington. They build cars there. And suppose there's a lawsuit involving the design of an automobile that's manufactured in Texas. And let's suppose that 10 years ago there was some discussion about this design, and so all the officers that are in charge of production in Arlington go up to Michigan to have their meeting to discuss this, and they, whatever they do, and then 10 years later there's an accident. Now there's a suit involving the design characteristics of that automobile, and they're in Texas suing, and now we have this argument. The meeting was in Michigan. The headquarters are in Michigan. The lawyers are in Michigan. Michigan has the most significant interest in the discussions that go on here, and it should not be controlled by a state 1,000 miles away who 10 years later
says this is what it is. Is your argument still accurate that Texas has no interest in the communications between officers who just happen to go to Michigan to have their meeting discussing design specifications of something that's manufactured in Texas?
Well, that might be, there would, the analysis would still be exactly the same. The restatement of conflicts approach would be the same. We determine what state has the most significant relationship to the communication that occurred, the most significant relationship to the attorney-client relationship in which the conversation occurred, and secondly, look at where the conversation actually occurred. Now, if in fact Texas residents go to Michigan to talk to a Michigan lawyer, then that throws another factor in that might change the balance, but that's not the case here. I mean, there are a number of conflicts cases, some of which are cited in our brief, in which someone, a California client, meets a Arizona lawyer in Nevada, and that gets into very complicated questions. The point is, that's not what occurred here. And what we're not dealing with here is jurisdiction. We're not contesting that Texas is not subject to jurisdiction of Texas, that Florida is not subject to Texas jurisdiction in this case.
Do you contend you win under the control group test as well? Or is that dispositive?
I see. Let me respond briefly to your question, Your Honor. Yes, we do, because the plaintiff's interpretation of the control group test is unworkably restrictive, even under Texas law. They take the position, and it apparently succeeded below, that Ford has to conclusively prove that everyone who ever attended this meeting or who ever saw the document in the intervening 10 years was himself a member of the board of directors of Ford Motor Company or a senior official, and that cannot be the test.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. George Quezada and Mr. Joel M. Feinberg will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Joel Feinberg, and together with Tex Quezada, we represent the real parties in interest in this case. In this case, the trial court did not abuse its discretion when it ordered production of a limited number of documents. Unlike Relator's portrayal of this case, the issues are very narrowly defined. This is not a case where a relator could not have proved up his privileges, but rather one where a relator chose not to prove up his privileges in accordance with well-settled Texas law, Supreme Court precedent, and legislative statutes.
You can see that they would have been privileged if they had met their procedural burden?
No, Your Honor, and I will address that. The procedural burden is wholly defective in this case. But even if you get past the procedural issue, there are substantive defects both in their proof and in the documents themselves which would render their position meritless.
Do you still contend that the trial court performed an in-camera inspection?
Well, Your Honor, what happened was there was a motion to compel hearing. Ford came down. We argued it. They never brought the documents with them. It was re-argued a month later. The documents, again, were not actually tender. A month later, the trial court entered its order compelling discovery. Ford shows up at that point with the documents. It never contests or never asked the trial court after it entered the order if these documents were so important to conduct an in-camera review. Never moved the court to vacate its order, never asked for a rehearing, never pointed out the error and gave the trial court an opportunity to go and look at these documents assuming that they were so important. Instead, it sought extraordinary relief from the Court of Appeals in this court. I think the law is pretty well settled that there's a presumption in favor of the trial court and that the trial court followed the law. If an in-camera review was required, certainly the trial court maintained plenty of power over these documents and over the order and could have vacated it if she wanted to.
So the problem here is that they never tendered the documents for in-camera inspection.
I don't believe that's the only issue. That's one of the issues. Now, there is a split in jurisdictions, Your Honor, or a split in Court of Appeals. Some believe that you need an actual tender. Some say that an offer of tender is enough.
Their documentation made an offer, did not.
That is correct, Your Honor. But I do not, again, believe that that is the issue.
Do you think they have to bring all the documents with them to the courthouse when they have the hearing and turn them over to the trial court at that time?
Your Honor, in this case, the documents consisted of five notebooks. It was not volumes of documents as it may be in other cases.
The principle would be the same regardless of the volume, wouldn't it?
The principle is in fact the same. However, in this case, bringing the documents was something that they could have done, but I don't think would have mattered. And that is the cornerstone of Relator's argument in this case. And that is that the trial court abused its discretion by not conducting an in-camera review. However, that Relator argument lacks merit because there are procedural and substantive defects. The first issue I'd like to address is the procedural, which we glossed over. The procedural defects is their affidavits were not sworn to be true and correct and were not based upon personal knowledge. This court recently in Humphreys versus Caldwell wrote that affidavits failing to meet that test do not pass muster, are not probative evidence, and cannot meet the evidentiary burden of proving a privilege.
They weren't sworn?
Your Honor, there is no affirmative statement in there that the information contained in those documents was true and correct.
Did it say it's under oath?
It did say it was under oath. As this court noted, you need the factual recitation that it's true and correct to make it an affidavit, to change it from a document with mere words on it to one that is sworn that all of the information in there is true and correct. And that wasn't done, and as a result, those affidavits have no probative value.
They were made under oath.
Yes, Your Honor. Even if you get past the procedural problems in this case, the affidavits do not pass substantive muster. The narrow issue in this case is whether or not Relator proved that the individuals obtaining or receiving the legal advice were clients within the meaning of the control group. Nowhere in any of the affidavits did Relator put any evidence whatsoever that those individuals were control group employees. As Justice Heck wrote sitting on the Dallas Court of Appeals in National County Mutual versus Hoffman, when the proof is so wholly insufficient, no in-camera review is required because resorting to the documents would itself be unnecessary. In this case, looking at the documents would not show that the individuals at that meeting were control group clients. Typically, the policy behind an in-camera review is that so the trial court can determine the substance, whether the documents themselves are that which would be a confidential communication between the lawyer and the client.
Sometimes isn't the document itself the best evidence of the privilege?
Exactly, Your Honor, and that's when there is an issue as to the substance. Does the document itself prove that this is the client, the attorney's work product? However, in this case, we don't have that issue. The only issue is whether or not the status of the individuals receiving the advice were clients. And that is not contained, will not be contained, and cannot be contained in those documents. They are meeting minutes. They are memorandum. They will not prove that all the individuals at those meetings were clients within the meaning of the control group.
Of course, you haven't had a chance to see them yet, have you?
No, Your Honor.
So we'd have to look at them to see what they show or whether, as Judge Owen suggests, that they might have information in them that would demonstrate that this is part of the control group or attorney-client relationship.
Your Honor, we believe that the Relator did not properly preserve its appellate record and bring those documents up under seal, as this court discussed in Pope versus Stevenson. But if the court were to look at the in-camera documents, I do not believe that those in-camera documents can conclusively prove that every individual at that meeting had the authority to hire a lawyer on behalf of Relator and have Ford Motor Company act on that lawyer's advice. And unless that status is proven, there's a fatal defect. They have missed the foundation in their privilege.
If I understand, the issue here is not to whom the document's directed. The issue is that these were documents present and circulated at a meeting at which people were in attendance, and there has been no identification by Ford that all the people that have been referenced, not by name, but by the generic term staff, were people that met the control group test. And so the problem with looking at the documents is not that the documents might show to whom or to not. The problem is that it has been represented that those documents have been seen by the staff and no identification of the staff as those people having been in the control room.
Your Honor, that is one of the issues, but I do not think that's the fundamental issue. The fundamental issue in this case is when the communication was made, when that proposed or alleged legal advice was given, were the individuals at that meeting clients within the meaning of the control group? And Ford has tendered no evidence whatsoever that they were clients. And in order to sustain a privilege under National Tank versus Brotherton, they must conclusively prove that all of those individuals at that meeting, not just all that looked at the documents later on, but all that were at the meeting that received the advice were clients. It is a narrowly tailored test crafted by this court, which Ford did not meet.
Mr. Feinberg, would you speak to the argument that Michigan law applies and under Michigan law these documents are privileged?
Your Honor, I would be happy to discuss it. Mr. Casada is better prepared to address that issue, and will probably give you a more complete answer. But
who's going to speak to the interrogatories?
Mr. Casada will do that as well. He will address the engineering documents, the settlements, and the conflicts of law question. However, if Your Honor wishes, I'd be happy to address it.
That's fine.
You say that the 1982 report by Ford's attorney to the Policy and Strategy Committee, comprised of senior officers and directors, does not foreclose the possibility that there were others present? Or are you saying that that description is not sufficient to show it was controlled?
No, Your Honor. In the actual affidavit or alleged affidavit signed by Mr. Burmeister, in that document it says that the committee members received this information and other Ford personnel there at the meeting. The other Ford personnel and the committee members do not establish the status, whether or not these lawyers met control group, or whether or not the individuals there met control group, and if they did not meet control group, then there is no privilege.
What if it was a stenographer? Would that waive the privilege?
No, Your Honor. And one of the fundamental issues that was brought up by Relator was that we're fashioning an unworkable test. That is not the case. All Relator had to do in this case was to show that the people at that meeting were there at the direction, control, and supervision of the lawyers that were acting on behalf of Ford Motor Company. In fact, in footnote 1 of National Tank versus Brotherton, this court notes that there may be a privilege for non-control group employees that act as representatives of the lawyer. If that stenographer were there, if the engineers were there, if the managers were there at the direction, control, and supervision, then Ford may have pled and proved its privileges. Ford just chose not to follow Texas law and establish either clients or representatives of the lawyer. That should have been done and could have been done in accordance with our standards as set forth by this court.
Why should a multinational corporation be required to prove the attorney-client privilege according to multiple different standards? In other words, they claim it's unfair to apply Texas law if it is different than Michigan law where it does its business. How is that a workable alternative?
Your Honor, again, Mr. Casada is a little better versed on this, but that's okay. That rule, as Relator speaks to Restatement Section 139 and encourages this court to adopt it, the restatement takes the position that you apply the law of the forum state with regard to privileges. That is a uniform application that when people bring a lawsuit in Texas, you apply Texas law on privileges. That is also the same rule that is followed in the federal courts, that in a diversity case, although you're applying state substantive law, you apply federal procedural law. It makes the courts run more efficiently. It also inures to the benefit of the litigants in that state. In Texas, and recently Justice Enoch in Republic Insurance versus Davis noted that there's a balancing test with the attorney-client privilege, one with the need for information, the other with the right for or the need for confidential communication. When this court looked at that balancing test, it came down and crafted National Tank versus Brotherton based on what the legislator put together Rule 503. That is a narrowly tailored test, which is to allow this balance to occur. In order for relators to prevail in this case, they are asking you to fundamentally change Rule 166B and require the trial court to conduct an in-camera review when one would not be necessary and one would not prove the privileges. Number two, in order for them to win, they are asking this court to disregard National Tank versus Brotherton and turn it on its head so that it does not say what it means, that only control group employees are clients. Anytime there is a disclosure to non-control group employees or non-clients, is an automatic waiver under this court's unanimous holding in Granada versus First Court of Appeals. Thank you very much for your time and consideration. Now Mr. Casado will address the remaining issues.
If it pleases the court, let me begin first with the conflict of law question that you posed. I think that in no small part, the conflict of law questions are somewhat of red herrings in this matter. First of all, a threshold for applying a foreign law in a Texas court under Rule 202 is for the party seeking to invoke that jurisdiction or that jurisdiction's law to plead and prove what that law is. That was not done at the trial court level. To this day, Ford has never pleaded precisely what attorney-client privilege applies from Michigan, where it is found, other than some cases that were first cited on appeal or on the mandamus. And that's under Rule 202. In addition, under conflicts of law principles, you almost always apply the procedure of the forum where the litigation is to be held. And if that is true, then Texas procedure applies, and certainly matters of proof, matters of privilege are considered procedural. Furthermore, under the American Law Institute's Restatement Second of Conflicts, the very same section that Ford Motor Company, or relator in this case, suggests that this court adopt, Section 139 of the Restatement Second of Conflicts says that evidence which is privileged under the local law of the state with the most significant relationship to the communication, that would be Michigan in this case, but which is not privileged under the local law of the forum, that's Texas, will be admitted unless there is some special reason why the forum policy favoring admission should not be given effect. That is Section 139 of the Restatement. That is the restatement every court that has considered 139 has adopted it. I believe the last count is about 7. Certainly, this court has indicated that the Restatement Second of Conflicts is persuasive on many points, and we've adopted many sections of the Restatement Second of Conflicts.
But isn't there a special reason, because if the forum law is always going to apply, then in essence, no state can protect attorney-client communications between its citizens or people who do business?
Well, the focus, Your Honor, is on whether there's some special reason why the forum policies, the forum state's policies should be disregarded. And there
isn't the reason that? Why isn't the reason that?
Well, I don't think the reason is that, Your Honor, in this case, because first of all, if that were true, then that section of the restatement would have no meaning whatsoever. It would never apply. Second, the restatement long ago abandoned the notion of territoriality with regard to privileges, certainly with regard to substantive law. And under Section 6, the principles of choice of the choice of law principles indicate that the forum law in procedural matters should be favored, and I think that's certainly true here. I don't see any compelling reason to abandon our attorney-client law as this court has formulated it. With regard to the settlement,
but you would have to abandon it if the law of Oklahoma were different and there was a suit up there. In other words,
you're right.
The law of Oklahoma was there was no attorney-client privilege, then even though Texas recognized it, if Texas litigants went up there, they wouldn't have it.
I think that may be right under Section 139, and that is a policy statement that the restatement authors, the ALI, felt comfortable making, and certainly the policy arguments there to support it. Whether this court follows 139, of course, is another matter. I think that it probably should. With regard to the settlements.
Interject before you go on to settlements. Do you lose under the Upjohn test? If you're wrong, the Texas control group attorney-client privilege applies under, if we decide Michigan law applies, do you lose?
Probably so. But I'm not, I don't want to give up on that without having looked at all of Michigan law. And in fact, in 1981, when many of these communications were taking place, Michigan used the control group test and has only since adopted the Upjohn test. So it's not as if some rug is being pulled out from beneath Relator. Now, quickly with regard to the settlements, I think that this court has properly decided not to get into the relevancy business, the mandamus business, in that context. I cannot find a case where this court has issued mandamus exclusively on relevance grounds. These documents may be relevant. They may not be relevant. The real issue is whether or not this court wants to turn mandamus into a second-guessing game anytime anyone believes that a trial court has required them to produce some sort of irrelevant documents.
Well, I mean, Ford Motor versus case from Freestone County, I think, with the million documents.
Yes, sir.
Is that anything other than relevant?
Well, the cases that I found...
You say undue burden.
Yes, sir. There are some cases, obviously, that hold that the documents producing them would be too expensive or burdensome. But that's not really Ford's argument here. And the cases I found closest on point from this court were a GM versus Lawrence, in which they were relevance grounds, but in addition, the document request or the order went beyond what the parties had agreed on. And recently, in Sears against Ramirez, this court implied that it might be irrelevant, but turned it on burdensome grounds on the income tax records. So I think that if this court were to issue mandamus in this case on relevance grounds of the settlement, that would be the first reported opinion from this court on a mandamus action suggesting that relevance is a ground for mandamus. And I think that would be improper. This court...
Mr. Sato, what is the authority for the trial court to order the amounts of paid by Ford to settle every Bronco rollover case? What's the authority for that?
Well, other than the rule, I don't know of any. I mean, the literal reason...
Is there any case law or rule?
There is some case law that says in some situations settlements are relevant, in some situations they're not. I think the clear reason, that the precise language of the rule gives her authority. I do not believe that this court should be in a position to rule that there is an abuse of discretion to apply Texas law when Michigan law was never pleaded, that it's an abuse of discretion to not follow the restatement in this case, and that somehow or another this court should immediately issue mandamus in relevance matters. I do not think that is the law. I do not think that should be the law.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to briefly address some of the major points raised by the respondent. With respect to this conflicts of law issue, there is no requirement that you plead in advance the law of a foreign jurisdiction that may cover the privileges attached to documents that have not yet been requested in discovery that hasn't yet happened in the case. The case is involving a necessity to plead a foreign law that applies to a case, or when you're arguing that the merits of the dispute will be governed by the law of a foreign state, and that's not the case here. Ford's not contending that the plaintiff's claims against it in this case will be governed by Michigan law. In response to the plaintiff's motion to compel in this case, Ford did draw the court's attention to the fact that communications are governed by the privileges under Michigan law and cited cases to the court describing what Michigan law is.
Mr. Martin,
that should be fully sufficient.
Is it, you have argued to this court that it just isn't right to have communications that are governed by one law 10 years ago be found to be not protected by law now, and Mr. Quesada has said, well, 10 years ago Michigan's law had a control group test. Do we follow up, John, in trying to make a determination as to whether or not Michigan law applies when Upjohn didn't apply then, or do we apply the law of Michigan that occurred at the time the communications occurred? Is that really our focus now, at what the law was at the time of the communications in determining whether or not that law should apply now?
The focus should be on determining what Michigan today would apply as by way of privilege to the communication that occurred in 1982.
If Michigan law today would not have recognized that as being attorney-client privilege, would you be arguing that same point?
We would have to, Your Honor. That's the law. And moreover, I do not believe that relator is correct.
You would argue that if Michigan changed the law to where the communications 10 years ago would have been privileged then but are not privileged now, you'd agree that they're not privileged and subject to being disclosed?
Privilege, yes, Your Honor. Whatever the Michigan law is what governs the privileges attached to this communication between a Michigan lawyer and a Michigan client in Michigan. That's what the law is, and we do not believe that the relator is correct in representing this court without authority that Michigan law was different in 1982.
So there's nothing inherently significant to the communications themselves. The only thing that's significant is whether or not a state says that this is a privilege or not a privilege.
I'm not sure I follow the question. Well, of course, it matters what the communication.
You say that if you have a communication that's clearly privileged at the time you have it, subsequently, the state where you have this communication says that's no longer a privilege, then you agree that those communications are discoverable. So there's nothing inherent in the communications themselves that is protectable at all. It's just because the state seems to say it's protectable.
The protectability of those documents is governed by the law announced by the state. This public policy is most direct interest in protecting them, and here that's Michigan.
So there's nothing unique that these communications occurred 10 years ago and today Texas is now applying what it considers to be a privilege.
The fact that it occurred 10 years ago demonstrates its complete and utter disconnection from any facts involving this accident.
But whether it's privileged or not is simply a function of what the current law is wherever, in your argument, wherever those communications occurred.
No, it's not necessarily wherever they occurred. It's wherever the state with the most significant relationship is. It's the law of the state with the most significant relationship to the privileges attached to that communication. And one of the factors in making that analysis is to determine where the communication occurred.
Well, but in a conflict of laws, you're talking about substantive law, wouldn't the events around which the lawsuit is be the determining factor of what the law is you apply? Conflict of laws, I mean, are we looking at communications between some of the parties as being what is significant about what law applies, or are we looking at the nature of the cause of action as to what laws apply?
The cause of action in this case is not relevant to the choice of law question on the privileges attached to this communication.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first matter. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.